The Sheriff contains graphic descriptions of violence, and in one episode, sexual assault. It may not be suitable for all listeners. I'm Tony Adami, and you're listening to The Sheriff, a new podcast series brought to you by the Northwest Florida Daily News and the Gannett Company. Hey, if you haven't listened to episode one of The Sheriff yet, I'd say go back and download it. It's called The Wheels of Justice, and I think it'll make you understand the story a lot better. The Sheriff is now available for download on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, so go ahead and check out that first episode.
The wheels of justice in Okaloosa County have a tendency to turn very slowly.
I'm going to give a quick recap of what we talked about in the first episode. In the first episode, I look back at the events leading up to the 1940 murder of Okaloosa County Sheriff's candidate Lester Wilson in Crestview, Florida. Lester, who had previously been the police chief in Crestview, was murdered inside of the front door of his home with his wife and two youngest children just feet away. An assassin shot him in the head with a double-barrel shotgun through a glass panel in his front door. One of Lester's children that was in the house that night was 12-year-old Ray Wilson. He was the closest to his father when he was shot, and he ran out of his bedroom and found him on the floor. 18 years later, Ray became the sheriff of Okaloosa County, the youngest in the history of the state of Florida. He was just 27, and eventually solved his father's murder. The time leading up to Lester's murder was what we put under the microscope the most in the first episode. And I know it was a lot to unpack. It went back to him coming to Okaloosa County in around 1915, we think, and went through his time as Crestview's police chief from 1929 to 1931, and his losses in the 1932 and 1936 Okaloosa County Sheriff's elections, which went to a surprise runoff between Lester and Sheriff Johnny P. Steele in 1936. Lester made a lot of enemies in that time. None of them were more dangerous than Johnny P. Steele and his close-knit group of deputies, constables, and friends. They were all determined to put a stop to Lester's ambition, one way or the other. And it was the other civilians that Lester had the most trouble with, not necessarily the police and the constables on the surface. The group was led by a guy named Murray MacArthur, a 27-year-old, good-looking, popular guy in the community. And he was also the son of Johnny P. Steele's chief sheriff's deputy, James Alty MacArthur Sr., went by J.A. He's also the younger brother of future sheriff James Alty MacArthur Jr., who went by Alty. Murray's close circle of friends included Charlie Powell, J.Q. Adams, and two brothers, Jesse and Doyle Kaysen. Things got really bad between the two groups in 1936 after the election, but things really came to a head in March 1939 when Murray MacArthur and Charlie Powell confronted Lester outside of a bar in Crestview. The confrontation ended with Lester shooting and killing Murray, who was just 27 years old, and shooting and severely wounding Powell, a man with a long history of violence, including a 1930 assault conviction for cutting another man, Jesse Linton, with a knife. According to Lester and his family, the gunfight with Murray and Charlie was the end of years of harassment, physical intimidation of Lester by Murray and members of his kind of pseudo-gang. And it was all done under the protection of the Okaloosa County Sheriff's Office. And all came as a direct result of Lester narrowly missing a win in the 1936 sheriff's election, which Steele was a heavy favorite in and had to beat Lester in a runoff. Afterward, Lester and his supporters were vocal about their belief that ballot stuffing had cost them the election. It caused a lot of problems. Lester, understandably, was arrested for manslaughter after he killed Murray MacArthur. But at his trial, Lester argued self-defense, and he was acquitted in one of the more sensational trials in state history to that point. I came complete with a witching hour, not guilty verdict that came back from the jury at 3 a.m. And that was after they came out at 9 p.m. and told the judge they were hopelessly deadlocked. He told them to go back in, argue it out, and he didn't care if it took all night. And it almost did. After his acquittal, Lester announced pretty quickly he was going to run for sheriff again in 1940. It would be his third try after losing in 1932 and 1936. But the difference this time was that he was quickly the odds-on favorite. Steele's party were really shook by the almost loss in 1936. And they were deciding to run a different candidate in a guy named H. Isle Enzer, one of the brothers in the powerful Enzer family in Okaloosa County. Two of H. Isle Enzer's brothers, Dr. Olin Enzer and Dr. Judd Enzer, founded and ran the first hospital in Okaloosa County, the Enzer Brothers Hospital, in 1926. For a long time, it was the only hospital between Pensacola and Mariana, so it covered a pretty huge region and served a lot of people. The problem for Lester announcing he was going to run for sheriff was that the threats on his life started coming pretty quick and fast at that point. And it wasn't just threats. One time he was offered $2,000 to drop out of the race. And there were even bigger offers, up to $10,000 even to move his family completely out of the county, which some of his friends thought was going to be a pretty good idea. But Lester was stubborn. He didn't want to back down from anybody. He'd had enough people come up to him and tell him that they were tired of the vice in Okaloosa County, mainly the gambling, the moonshiners, and the prostitution that had become rife, and that they wanted a change. This is The Sheriff, Episode 2, The Night Gunman.
Your father beat him.
Did he?
No, he did. Heard the story a thousand times.
That's Bran Stark in Season 6 of Game of Thrones. So, I guess that's my really nerdy way of saying that our family histories aren't always what they think they are. And sometimes we put a shine on things because it makes us look better, or makes our family look better. And how it brings back to our story is that while I was able to get a lot of the Wilson family history via court records, old documents, and talking with Lester's grandson and Ray's son, Stuart, there's also another side of the story that we shouldn't forget about. And that's the MacArthurs.
Tell me, your father, you said he did talk about Murray. Tell me what he said about Murray.
Murray, that he was a marvelous young man.
Okay.
That's Murray's niece, Penny Janowski. Her father, James Alty MacArthur Jr., Alty, was a longtime engineer for the state's road department and also served as Okaloosa County Sheriff from 1950 to 1952.
He and another man named Charlie Powell approached the car where a guy who had been kicked out as either sheriff or deputy sheriff shot them through the window. They were just kidding around, and he shot them both, but only Murray died.
And go ahead.
I read the obit in the paper from Murray, and as it said, he was one of the most well-liked, nicest young men in the county. Yeah, it was brought up, it's a very sad subject, so it was not brought up often at all, other than how wrong it was.
The man was acquitted.
Oh, yeah.
And then that same person was murdered a year later.
Like I said before, Murray and James was older, Alty was older. Their father, James Alty MacArthur Sr., was the chief sheriff's deputy under multiple sheriffs and died in 1933 on duty when he was making an arrest working for Sheriff Johnny P. Steele, who was the one who Lester had so many problems with.
The story I told about my grandfather dying was he was a deputy sheriff also.
Mm, yeah.
Back seat of a car with a whoever they were taking to jail, and the guy said to the driver, hey, this deputy sheriff just fell over.
Penny founded and ran a really successful band camp in St. Petersburg, Florida for 41 years. It's called Penny's Band Camp. She retired in 2013. We talked for about an hour, and I think she's probably the best person alive today who can speak to the MacArthur family's experience as to what happened during the time we're looking at. I'm really lucky she has such a great memory, and I know at the end, things between me and her took kind of a bad turn, but I'm still glad she was willing to talk to me. And just like the story I told of the Wilsons in the first episode, I'd like to tell the MacArthur's backstory. It won't be as long as the Wilsons' backstory, but I think it's important to tell their story as well. It's a backstory that has pretty deep ties to the founding of Okaloosa County. It's also a family history that overlaps and interconnects with a lot of the men who we know now were in on the plot to assassinate Lester Wilson. As most public records go, the first thing I could find about the MacArthurs was a newspaper article from September 21st, 1903, in addition to the Pensacola News Journal that had a little piece on J.A. MacArthur Sr. That would be Alty and Murray's dad. He was only J.A. MacArthur then, because he hadn't had any kids yet. He was 23 years old, and he'd been arrested for bootlegging liquor. The charge was selling liquor without a license, and he had a court date set for September 29th. I couldn't find what the final outcome of the case was, however, but as we do know, he did go on to become a chief sheriff's deputy. J.A. Sr. and his wife, Kate, had two sons, Alty in 1907 and Murray in 1909, along with two daughters. The boys were incredibly close. One of the next things I found was a letter from Alty to Santa in December of 1914. Here's what the letter said.
Dear Santa Claus, I'm writing here to let you know what I want. I want a cat, pistol, and a knife. My little brother Murray wants a cat, pistol, some other fireworks, and a knife. I am 7 years old and in the fourth grade.
That's Levi Tomachek reading the letter that Alty wrote to Santa Claus in 1914, where he asked for gifts from Murray as well. I think it really goes to show how close the brothers were actually at a very young age, and kind of gives some insight into what the family was like, and how much Alty looked out for Murray. Now, as we mentioned before, the tragedy that struck the family in 1933 was that Alty and Murray's father, J.A. Sr., the top chief sheriff's deputy in Okaloosa County, died during a routine arrest. He arrested a man named George Atwell, a local bootlegger, and Johnny P. Steele was one driving them back to Crestview to put Atwell in jail. J.A. Sr. sat in the back seat with Atwell, had a massive heart attack, and died. Just a year later, things would change again in a pretty big way for the MacArthurs when Alty married Melanie Maples. Melanie was the daughter of a man named William H. Maples, who is widely credited for founding Okaloosa County in 1915. It's even on his headstone in Crestview where it says, "Founded Okaloosa County." He was a very powerful man, and their wedding was front page news. Everyone who was anyone in Crestview was there. Murray was his best man. Jesse Kaysen, one of Murray's best friends, was his wife, Connie Enzer, the daughter of Olin Enzer, one of the doctors who founded the Enzer Brothers Hospital. She was one of the bridesmaids. Melanie was Penny's mom. And also, because we have this article that talks about everybody that was there and what their roles were, we know now at this wedding that at least one of the men who would be put on trial for killing Lester Wilson and at least a half dozen others who would testify in his defense were also at the wedding that day. Murray's killing in 1939 hit the whole town hard, especially the MacArthurs, obviously, and the group of friends they had around them. The paper of record, the Okaloosa News Journal, ran an article we talked about in the first episode that talked about what a great guy Murray was. And I'm not saying that I don't believe that, but the man that ran the Okaloosa Journal at that time, Bob Sykes, was someone that was also pretty close with the MacArthurs and had a history of not telling the truth in his own newspaper. So by the time that Murray was murdered in 1939, he was leading a much different life than Alty was, his big brother. Alty had a wife, a kids, and a brand new home on Millionaire's Row in Crestview. Murray still ran with the crowd. He was 27. He had the Kaysen brothers, Doyle and Jesse, Charlie Powell and J.Q. Adams among them. Here's some audio that we played in the first episode from the testimony of Woodrow Wilson, Lester Wilson's son, that can give us a little more background on that group of friends. You testified, I believe, that your father had some trouble with these other boys.
No, sir, I didn't say he had trouble.
I mean, some other boys jumped on him. Excuse me, Woodrow.
Yes, sir, some other fellows. I didn't say these boys.
Who were the other boys?
Murray MacArthur and Chance Powell, and on one occasion, J.Q. Adams.
You said Chance Powell, but do you by chance mean Charlie Powell?
Yes, sir, Charlie Powell.
Thank you. At Murray MacArthur's funeral, Johnny P. Steele, the Okaloosa County Sheriff, William H. Maples, state senator, former judge, and the founder of Okaloosa County, and a man named Newman Bracken, who ran a drugstore in downtown Crestview, will be a state senator for decades, all served as honorary pallbearers. In 1958, during the trials of the men accused of killing Lester Wilson, Steele and Bracken also were called to testify for the defense. After Murray's murder, the group of men that he was kind of the de facto leader for were pretty listless, meaning that they didn't have anyone to tell him what to do. Unlike Alty, Jesse Kaysen's marriage to one of the more prominent families in Crestview had fallen apart because of his drinking and womanizing. He and Connie Enzer, the daughter of the Dr. Olin Enzer, who founded the Enzer Brothers Hospital, divorced in 1936. His younger brother, Doyle Kaysen, who ended up being married 5 times, spiraled quickly in alcoholism, like his big brother. By 1940, following Murray's murder, both of the brothers had reached a point of desperation and poverty. Jesse had remarried quickly to a woman named Mamie, and they had 2 children, a son, Ooh Lee, and a daughter, Juanita. In the 1940 census, Jesse listed his occupation as fruit buyer. saying he worked an average of 50 hours per week, although he also had a taxi service he ran around that time that he listed as other source of income. Doyle spent almost all of his time finding work where he could and drinking with his friend Burris Brown, known around Crestview as One-Eyed Burris Brown. Lester Wilson's candidacy for sheriff in 1940 and his popularity among the masses had done little to bury the idea that Johnny P. Steele hadn't been a very good sheriff, nor had Joe Adams been a very good constable in their time in office. But to really understand this more, we need to look at that Johnny Steele and Joe Adams weren't just looked at as being a bad sheriff and bad constable. They were looked at as having let Lester Wilson get away with the murder of one of the town's kind of golden boys, so to speak, and the son of one of their former colleagues, Deputy Sheriff Jay MacArthur, and the younger brother of one of their really close friends, Alty MacArthur. Steele's inability to control Lester Wilson and protect the interests of the old guard in Okaloosa County had led to his public declaration that he wouldn't be a candidate in 1940. And that leads us up to March 15, 1940, the day of Lester's murder. You're listening to The Sheriff, a new podcast series from the Gannett Company in the Northwest Florida Daily News. Here's how I'd like to tell you about the day Lester Wilson was murdered, March 15, 1940. First, from Lester's point of view, then after we get to the murder itself, I can start filling in the blanks, and my hope is that it will be like driving out of a rainstorm when I do the latter. And that I mean that as I'm telling you about what happened to Lester, that's going to be the worst part of the storm, where our windshield wipers are set at the highest level and we can still barely see the road. When I start to fill in the blanks, I can give us kind of a Rashomon-style view of the story, where we start to see it from different viewpoints until we understand the whole thing. Not unlike some movies like Gone Girl or The Usual Suspects. So back to March 15, 1940. In the first episode, we talked about how much colder Crestview is than anywhere else in Northwest Florida, and March 15th, 1940 wasn't any different. It was a Friday and it was really cold. According to weather reports from that day, the weather was in the 40s to 30s. Lester would have worked the first shift at the taxi stand, rising early to drive the car to the Sunray Cafe in downtown Crestview, which was about 1 mile south of the family's home at 748 Long Drive. The way the taxi stand worked was there were three taxis that operated: Joe Adams' taxi, Jesse Kaysen's taxi, and Lester Wilson's, with Lester's being the preferred taxi of the three. The taxis collected fares by either people walking up to the cab stand and waiting for a ride, or by calling the Sunray Cafe, where all the taxi owners helped split the phone bill each month for its use. So someone could call the Sunray Cafe to see if there were any cabs available, and the owners usually hung out in the cafe when they weren't busy. So the role the Sunray Cafe played in this was pretty minimal for the Wilsons, other than that they worked out of there. They didn't spend a lot of time hanging out there. Jesse Kaysen did, and he got drunk a lot. He was in there drinking beer, and he wasn't usually driving his cab unless someone really was desperate. Joe Adams had to work a lot. He had a full-time job as a constable, and so his cab didn't run that much either. So it meant the Wilsons were not just the preferred one, they were the one that was the most reliable for the people in the town. At around 7:45 p.m. on March 15th, Lester asked Woodrow if he could drive him home so he could listen to the 8 p.m. news with Elmer Davis on the radio. Riding with Woodrow and Lester was Vinnie Davis, a taxi fare, and a woman who lived just two houses down from them on Long Drive with her parents and her younger brother Curtis, who was 16 years old at the time. And there was a good reason for Lester to want to come home and listen to the news every night. At that time, America was barreling toward World War II in Europe, and with several sons who were military age, he wanted to stay up on what was going on overseas.
Nations bring you Elmer Davis and the news.
The recent report from Paris that the Allies are contemplating an attempt at the encirclement of Russia by attacks from the north and south found support in various pieces of evidence today.
Woodrow dropped Vinnie Davis off, then moments later dropped Lester off in front of their house. He turned his car around to head back downtown to the cab stand in Crestview. At this point, it would have been no later than 7:50 p.m. Now here's where I'm going to start to give you some different points of view on what happened that night. And I think it's important to establish that no one in the Wilson home that night got a good look at the killer, or killers. Here's Bama Wilson, Lester's wife, talking about what was going on inside of the house right after he was shot. As I said before, this is a reenactment of the trial transcript from 1958. Did your husband turn the radio on?
Yes, sir.
What happened after that?
After the news, he turned somewhere else and was listening to music or something. I don't remember what.
Then what happened?
Well, I heard an awful explosion. Gunfire. It went like a terrible explosion.
Mrs. Wilson, how many explosions did you hear, please?
Just one.
Were you still seated and looking into the fire at that time?
Yes, sir.
Your back was turned to the front door, is that correct?
Not right to the door, but my back was toward my husband sitting by the radio.
So you were not looking in the direction of the front door?
No, sir.
What did you do upon hearing this explosion?
Jumped up, opened the front door, turned on the porch light, and looked across. In front was an old field, and I looked out across there.
Did you see anything at that time?
No, sir.
Did you see anybody?
No, sir.
Did you see any automobiles?
No, sir.
Where was the light that you had to turn on?
The switch was right by the door.
On the inside of the house, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and that turned on the porch light?
Yes, sir.
When you did that and looked and saw nothing, did you go out onto the porch?
I just stepped outside the door. I didn't see anybody.
Okay, Mrs. Wilson. Then what did you do?
I didn't see anybody. Then I turned around and saw what happened.
When you turned around, where was Mr. Wilson?
Lying on the floor.
Where was the chair in which he had been seated?
It was turned over on the floor.
At that time, did you observe a wound on Mr. Wilson anywhere?
I did.
How many separate or distinct wounds did you observe?
Just the one.
Please, ma'am, describe that wound to the court and the jury, please.
Well, it was the left side of his head that was torn off.
Now, when you speak of the left side of his head, I realize you were not a doctor, but was the wound into the head like this, or was it in the back of the head?
It was back, this way, just taking part of the top off.
All on the left side?
Yes, sir.
You observed the wound, did you not?
I did.
Do you know how long Mr. Wilson lived after receiving that wound?
No, sir, but it wasn't but a few minutes.
Ray was in his room and didn't come out till he heard his father get shot. Velma, the only daughter, was in her room, didn't come out till she heard her father get shot. J.W. Miller, Bama's father and Lester's father-in-law, was on the other side of the living room, but he was slow to get up. He's a little bit older. He didn't see anyone either. For all intents and purposes at this point, we now understand everything that was going on in the Wilson household. After being dropped off by Woodrow, Vinnie Davis went inside and sat down at the window in her living room, facing the direction where she could see the Wilson's house to her left, all of Long Drive right in front of her, and to her right, she could see U.S. Highway 85, which some people call Laurel Hill Highway. It's the same road, just with different names. A few minutes after she sat down, Vinnie saw a car come off Laurel Hill Road / Highway 85, and it slowed down as it approached the Wilson's house. It passed by, turned around, and drove slowly back through the street. Then it picked up speed when it went past the Wilsons and back toward the highway. Then, a few minutes later, Vinnie saw another car repeat that same route, off the highway, toward the Wilsons, turn around, slow down in front of the Wilsons' house, then come back toward the highway at a high rate of speed. A few minutes later, a possible third car backed up in front of the Davis' house all the way to the fence. This car was black. It backed up so it was facing the highway, had its back or its bumper toward the Wilson's house after it got turned around. Vinnie ended up being an excellent witness in the case in 1958. One of my co-workers, Ashley Wild, who is actually from Crestview, was nice enough to record Vinnie's testimony, or part of her testimony, in the trial in 1958. So here's what Vinnie said happened after the third car backed into her driveway. And then what did you see?
Very soon after that, we heard a gun shoot.
How many times did you hear a gun shoot?
Once.
Then what did you do?
I got up and went to the door.
Did you walk or run to the door?
I walked. Outside and out on the front porch.
So you went outside?
Yes.
What did you see, Vinnie?
I saw Miss Wilson walking from the door to the steps on her porch with the porch light on.
Did you see any automobiles out on the lane then?
No, sir.
Did you see any people?
No, sir.
But you did see Mrs. Wilson?
Yes, sir.
Did you hear anything from the Wilson house, other than the shot, I mean?
I heard her crying and taking on.
What did you do after that?
I ran up there.
By yourself?
No, sir. With my father.
What did you find when you arrived at the Wilson home?
I found him lying there in the front door, dead. Or dying, at least.
Okay. As I understand it, when you first came out the door, you did not see anyone or any cars on the lane at that time?
Yes, sir.
Were you blinded by any lights?
Not right then.
Were you blinded by lights later?
As I went up there, yes, sir.
So while you were running from your house to the Wilson house, did you see anybody or any cars? I know you saw Mrs. Wilson, but did you see anybody else or any cars on the lane?
Yes, sir. Two cars.
And which way were they headed?
Toward the Lower Hill Highway.
Okay. What were those two cars? Where were they when you saw them?
About halfway between our house and the Wilsons.
How close were the cars together?
Right close together.
Did you get a good look at the cars?
No, sir, because the lights were turned on in my face and it blinded me.
What was their speed, Jeannie?
They were still. They were parked with the lights on.
I don't think you have to have a law degree or be a police officer to understand that the cars that Vinnie Davis saw that night, the ones that came down her block before the shooting and the ones she saw afterward, were cars full of men involved in the shooting and the assassination of Lester Wilson. The one thing all these cars have in common is that the last time that Vinnie saw them, they were all headed toward Laurel Hill Highway, which would have been the only exit off of Long Drive. Vinnie and her father would have come upon a pretty horrific scene. They would have been the first ones outside of the home itself to see what had happened to Lester, with half of his head blown off from a shotgun blast. They also would have seen Ray standing over his father's body, trying to help. They weren't the only witnesses on the block. Mrs. W.R. White, who lived directly next door to the Wilsons, told a reporter for the Pensacola News-Journal that after she heard the gunshot, she opened her front door and heard a man running through her yard, then heard an automobile door slam shut and a car drive away. Now, she wouldn't have been able to make out the man running because it would have been totally dark out there, but the door that she heard slam shut would have been the same one that Vinnie heard slam shut. Just across U.S. Highway 85 from Long Drive were the Huttos. This was Sharon, Lester's sister, and Alfred, his brother-in-law, and their children. Alfred Hutto came running out of the house when he heard the screaming. First his wife, and then Bama in the distance. "It's Bama, it's Bama," his wife told him. And he just started running, sprinting directly toward where the Wilsons lived. Out on U.S. Highway 85, there was another key witness in the trial. Curtis Davis, Vinnie Davis' younger brother. He was about to see something he would never be able to wipe from his memory. You're listening to The Sheriff, a new podcast series from the Northwest Florida Daily News and the Gannett Company. Curtis was walking the 1 mile or so from downtown Crestview to his home on Long Drive. He was approaching a service station approximately 1 block or 1/4 mile from the turn onto Long Drive off of Highway 85. Curtis said he heard what he called an explosion, but he ignored it and kept walking toward Long Drive. Within the next minute, he saw a 1938 Ford and a 1937 Ford come off of Long Drive and turn onto U.S. Highway 85 toward him, going about 70 miles per hour. As the cars came onto the highway, Curtis stepped back from the road into the shadows where he couldn't be seen. Moments later, a 1934 Ford came off of Long Drive, going about 40 or 50 miles per hour, and went straight across the highway and onto a dirt road. Curtis recognized two of the cars immediately. The 1938 Ford that was speeding toward him, and the 1934 Ford that jumped over Laurel Highway and went onto the dirt road. There were several other witnesses in the trial who corroborated Curtis's testimony about who the first car belonged to. I'll let him tell it. As to the 38 Ford and the 37 Ford that passed you, the 38 Ford with the spotlight and radio antenna and the other black car, were you able to identify either of those as to the ownership?
The 38 Ford with the spotlight and the radio antenna belonged to Joe Adams, at the time the constable. The 37 Ford I could not identify.
Curtis wasn't the only one in the trial who testified about being really familiar with Joe Adams' car. He was, after all, the town constable. Do you know what kind of a car Mr. Joe Adams was driving in his official capacity as constable or deputy sheriff, as distinguished from his actual cab?
He used the same car for both businesses right at that time.
What kind of a car was he operating?
A black Ford.
Do you remember the year or the approximate year of that car?
I believe it was a 38 Ford.
Do you remember any distinguishing or identifying features on Mr. Adams' black Ford?
He had a spotlight and a radio on his car.
Curtis recognized the third car as well. The 1934 Ford that came over Laurel Highway was black with red wheels. About a half dozen people at the trial in 1958 testified to who owned this car. It was Doyle Kaysen. By midnight, E. Dixie Beggs, the federal prosecutor assigned to investigate the case, was in Crestview. Unfortunately, it would be almost 20 years before Curtis and Vinnie would tell what they actually saw that night and what they experienced, out of fear. Curtis testified at the 1940 grand jury and then the 1952 grand jury in this case. Both times he left out important parts of his story. He wouldn't tell the whole truth until 1957, when he was tracked down by Pensacola Police Department investigator Walter Steinasek and Okaloosa County Sheriff Ray Wilson, Lester Wilson's son. It was then that he told the whole story. Here's a clip of Curtis from the trial in 1958, trying to explain to defense attorneys why he hadn't told the whole story back then.
And I assume at that time you told him the same story you did today.
No, sir, and I'll tell you why. I was a kid and I was scared, and my people had told me to keep quiet.
Curtis was probably right to be scared. He also wasn't the only one who would take over a decade to finally tell what they saw on the night of March 15, 1940. Unbelievably, is what they experienced after the murder that instilled the most fear in them. For Vini, it was that night, in the Wilson's home, and people were coming in and out of the house. That's when she ran into Doyle Kaysen. Here's what she said happened. In what part of the house did your conversation first take place?
In the kitchen.
Mrs. Davis, tell us what he said to you and what you said to him.
I said if I had minded my mother, I might have seen whoever shot Mr. Wilson. Doyle said, yes, but that little if always stands in the way. It might have been best if you didn't.
The next day's coverage in the Okaloosa News Journal would have done nothing but further cement Vini, Curtis, and many others' idea that they should not talk. The article on the murder stated that Lester had many enemies, and authorities had no clue who the killer was, that no one saw the killer run up to or away from the house. The article in that paper, Les Wilson Killed by Gunman, gives no backstory on where Wilson's enemies came from, and totally omits the killing of Marie MacArthur 1 year earlier. It also goes out of its way to make the Wilsons seem poor, describing their house as small because it couldn't fit hundreds of people into it for the funeral. I can't reiterate how shameful it was for Bob Sykes to let stuff like this get in his paper, especially considering his relationship with the people on one side of the conflict. Thank goodness for the Pensacola Journal at this time. The article that ran describing the killing, Sheriff Candidate Killed by Night Gunman, ran top-stripped across the cover. It was a big enough story at the time that whoever was running the news journal decided that it needed two extra subheads. Those are the smaller headlines you see on newspapers. Some people call them kickers. One of them said, Lester Wilson is shot from porch of home. And another one said, former police chief had been acquitted of killing MacArthur. Something that the Pensacola Journal thought was good enough to put in one of their subheads, the Okaloosa News Journal did not even mention in their story. There is no author credited to that article. It just said special in the byline. But it does give us some details that may have otherwise been lost to history. Mainly, it points out that while Lester was shot at 8 p.m., Sheriff Johnny P. Steele did not show up at the house until after 10:15 p.m. at least. And the reason for his absence given was that he'd been serving warrants in the northern part of the county, which is also where Crestview is located. When Steele did show up, he was not granted admittance into the home by Fox Wilson, Lester's brother, and Woodrow Wilson, Lester's son. He turned and went away, didn't ask any questions. We also have the story told to us by Stuart Wilson, Lester's grandson and Ray's son, about what happened to Ray that night later when he was sitting in his bedroom.
Dad died about 5 years ago. He didn't tell me this till 6 years ago. And he said, son, I never would tell anybody because I carried this myself all these years, but I'm letting you know what happened. He said, I sat on the edge of that bed, and as I was picking pieces of my dad and your granddad's skull, bones, fragments, and blood and tissue, brain matter, I stepped in it. And as I was trembling and cleaning my feet, two policemen outside my window said, each one to another, you know they'll never catch the killer or killers. He said, yes, I know it.
Constable Joe Adams, who lived in Crestview and was directly responsible for overseeing the safety of its citizens, did not show up at the Wilson House at all. His whereabouts in the article in the News Journal were listed as unknown. So, one of the most prominent, well-known citizens in the county, in Okaloosa County, is murdered, and dozens of citizens on their own, including some of the people involved in the murder, show up at the Wilson's house that night. But no one from the Okaloosa County Sheriff's Office. Not for at least 2 hours. You've been listening to The Sheriff. It's a new podcast from the Northwest Florida Daily News and the Gannett Company. You can find it wherever you usually get your podcasts from. You can also go to nwfdailynews.com for more information on this case, including pictures, stories, and background information on all the people involved. Florida Governor Fred P. Cohn didn't waste much time looking into the murder. Right away, that same night, as I said, he sent E. Dixie Beggs, a federal prosecutor from Pensacola, into Crestview to look into it. Within days, he was joined by H. Clay Mitchell, a state investigator. And the two of them learned quickly what we know now. that Lester had a lot of enemies, that he was in constant fear for his life for several years, and that he had refused to leave the county out of fear. They learned about the offer of $2,000 to drop out of the sheriff's race. They learned about the offer for $10,000 to move out of the county. They learned that Lester was not interested in either one of them. In one of his few quotes given to the Pensacola News Journal, Beggs went on record saying, Lester had either unwavering friends or bitter enemies, and there wasn't any in between. The Wilsons held Lester's funeral on Monday at their home. Hundreds of people had to wait outside. Then there was a funeral procession. By that same Monday, Beggs and Mitchell were back in Crestview, but they clammed up quite a bit as far as what they were saying publicly, only that they were back in town and hoped to find the killer soon and make an arrest. Sheriff Steele continued to spit out the same lines over and over. $250 reward, clues were scarce, and they had no idea who the killers were. Several newspaper articles said there were at least six suspects, but their names were never released. Bob Sykes, again, the man who ran the Okaloosa News Journal and was also running for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives, and who had arguably done as much as anyone to make sure the case didn't gain traction in the media, weighed in a few weeks later, saying he'd called on Cohn personally to bring in the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Justice must be done to society and to the family and friends of Lester Wilson, Sykes said. The good name of this county and our people must have the right to feel that such acts will not go unpunished. Sykes, who had served as a pallbearer at the funeral of Murray MacArthur, he made no such declarations in his own paper, where he was prone to writing lavish 100-point front-page editorials on any number of topics. Just not on the murder of Lester Wilson. By April 28th, Beggs and Mitchell were ready to admit defeat. They admitted they had no clues and no suspects, and they asked for a grand jury to be convened in Crestview to investigate Lester's murder. They began taking testimonies from the grand jury within days. The grand jury was convened in Crestview and included members of the community who definitely had affiliations to one side or the other, including Frank Enzer, a close personal friend of the MacArthurs, and J.B. Wilkerson, a distant cousin of Murray MacArthur. And as far as the investigation into Lester Wilson's murder, that was pretty much it. No arrests or indictments from the 1940 grand jury, and other than an occasional flare-up from Fox Wilson in the press, most notably when he accused Governor Fuller Warren of removing him as constable in Crestview's district after he pressed Warren too hard on reinvestigating the murder, that really was it. Until 1952, when a drifter in North Carolina, Ed Rutland, who claimed he was one of the men who had conspired to murder Lester Wilson. Rutland's story came under pretty heavy scrutiny right from the beginning. He said there were four other men involved, but the only one he ever saw for sure was the man who pulled the trigger. And that man had worn a hood the entire time, a story that was deemed unbelievable by a grand jury that was also convened in 1952. Rutland, however, had lived in Crestview for several years, but had left town in 1942, and he had known Lester Wilson. The sheriff in Okaloosa County at the time of Rutland's confession, quote-unquote confession, was Altie MacArthur, who served from 1950 to 1952 after H. Isle Enzer, the man that Lester Wilson would have gone against in the 1940 election, was ousted from office in 1950 by Governor Fuller Warren for not enforcing gambling laws. Altie MacArthur only became the sheriff after Farron Campbell, who would be one of the defense attorneys in Lester Wilson's murder trial, was named sheriff initially, until Governor Warren found out that Campbell was H. Isle Enzer's son-in-law, therefore pulling him out of office and putting Altie MacArthur in. Now, it may have been lip service, but right off the bat, Altie said that he was going to arrest Rutland for aiding in a murder. But Rutland's path to Crestview was diverted by state officials, who ordered him brought to Pensacola first. That's where Rutland told the police and newspaper reporters that he was in the getaway car with the shooter. And after he murdered Lester Wilson, he asked the shooter who he was. And the man responded by saying, "I could be any one of four people, you crazy bastard." Rutland's story actually changed so much, depending on who he told it to, that eventually no charges were brought, even though Altie convened another grand jury to look into Lester's murder. So for the second time, a grand jury in Crestview convened to investigate Lester's murder and came away with no arrests. And not long after the second grand jury was convened, H. Isle Enzer was back in office. It was business as usual in Okaloosa County. For the Wilsons, without the main breadwinner in the household and four out of the six children still school age, things got hard fast. And they had to come together like never before. I mean, it was part of kind of surviving and the family doing whatever they needed to keep getting along. Thankfully, they still had Bama Wilson, who was one of the stronger, more resolute women I've ever heard of. Beginning the night of the murder, she kept a brave face. She would always say she still hoped that her husband's killers would be brought to justice one day. In private, she preached to her family on what she thought was the most important part of their healing after Lester's murder. which she said was forgiveness. She thought that the need for revenge was as dangerous as anything that could get in a person's heart. That anger and resentment and bitterness would only poison the well. So while Bama tried to preach the need for forgiveness, alongside the need for justice, at least two people never gave up on the investigation. That was Lester's brother, Fox Wilson, and his youngest son, Ray Wilson. The two chased leads around the county and the region for years. If they heard a rumor about somebody that knew something about Lester's murder, they went out there and they looked into it. They filled up notebook after notebook with leads they followed, and eventually, it seemed like they were always pulling on the same threads. This went on until Ray graduated from Crestview High School in 1946 and enrolled in the Navy, where he went and served in the infantry as military police in the years leading up to the Korean War. When Ray got out of the military, he moved to Port St. Joe, where he worked for a paper mill, and he got married to his wife, Virginia. And you can make an argument that Ray marrying Virginia served as much of a part in solving this murder as anything. And why was she so important? She was important because she knew what was important to Ray. She knew that no matter what he did, no matter what career he held, that the thing that was going to motivate him and the thing that was always going to be in his heart was wondering who killed his father. Finally, one day she went to him and said, "Ray, I don't know what we're still doing in Port St. Joe. We got to get back to Crestview, get you elected sheriff, and figure out who killed your dad." And that's exactly what they did. On the next episode of The Sheriff.
Well, I don't want anything said disparaging about my dad because he's innocent in the whole thing. It was a very sad thing, and I would like you to be very careful what you say about that.
Remember, does either one of you remember a family, the Kaysens?
Yep.
What can you tell me about the Kaysens?
Well, they've been around here for years.
Yeah.
The Kayson family had. One of them ran a liquor store past Mar Camp down there. Raymond, that was one brother.
Yeah.
Doyle was another brother. Mm-hmm. And Jess was another brother.
What about Jess? Jesse? Yeah.
The sheriff is recorded at the Northwest Florida Daily News in Fort Walton Beach, Florida. The sheriff is written and researched by Tony Adami and edited by Nick Tomachek. Additional voice work on this episode was done by Nathan Cobb, Levi Tomachek, Ashley Wild, Savannah Evanoff, and Sam Grubenhoff.
Perfect.
That perfect?
That was perfect. Thanks, buddy.